There were times where the company provided us with wine for holiday meals, yes.
Did you at any time take alcoholic beverages on the vessel when you went ashore, like in Valdez?
Ashore?
Yes.
Please rephrase.
Did you ever take alcoholic beverages back on the vessel when you...
Back on the vessel, no.
Were you ever invited into Captain Hazelwood's cabin to drink alcoholic beverages?
No, sir.
When you went ashore with Captain Hazelwood on this last trip in Valdez, you reported, as I understood your testimony to the office, to the agent's office, and you were informed at that time that the vessel was going to sail, what, an hour earlier than you expected when you left the vessel?
No, sir, an hour later.
An hour later. Pardon me?
An hour later than we expect. An hour later than when we left the vessel.
I see. Okay. When you were drinking with Captain Hazelwood on the day before the grounding, were you aware at any time or at any point that there might have been some impairment rather than intoxication of either Captain Hazelwood or yourself?
I am not sure how I would judge the difference, between the two.
How would you characterize an individual who might have too much alcohol?
I don't know how to answer that question, sir.
What are the signs and symptoms of alcohol use?
One could stagger. One could be unsteady on his feet. One can slur his words.
Did you detect any of those symptoms on the night you were boarding the vessel or just before you boarded the vessel?
No, sir.
Are you aware in your own use of alcohol that there may be some impairment in thought processes and that sort of thing before you would see those visual signs of intoxication and or impairment?
Sir, I personally do not like to get drunk.
Are you aware of any other evidences of impairment that would not be necessarily visual observations of an individual who is intoxicated?
I'm not certain, sir, no.
When did you become aware that Captain Hazelwood may have had a chemical dependency problem?
I can't say exactly, but being working for a company for 19 years, you hear certain rumors, but these are innuendos and rumors, and I can't exactly answer you.
When did you first hear a rumor to that effect?
I don't recall, sir.
Was it prior to the grounding?
Yes, this could have been a few years before that. I can't tell you.
But you think it would have been before the grounding?
Oh, yes, certainly.
Had you been aware of any other issues surrounding Captain Hazelwood's chemical dependency problem?
No, sir.
No further questions.
Thank you, Dr. Brunke. Mr. Howitt.
Mr. Chairman, we have no questions.
Thank you. Commander Waldron.
So You're listening to live coverage of the National Transportation Safety Board investigation into the wreck of the Exxon Valdez. We're live from the Captain Cook. This is brought to you by KSK Anchorage and APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network. On the stand now is Jerzy Glowacki, chief engineer for the Exxon Valdez. He's being questioned by Coast Guard Commander Darrell Waldron.
Is engaged.
No, sir, not the specific engagement of it. No, it's not printed out, no.
Is it another position on the engine or telegraph?
No. Prior to load programming up, the throttle position or the telegraph position would be at full ahead and remain there while you load programming up.
Okay. Who does the load programming up? Is it the engine room or is it the bridge?
It depends where the engine control is placed.
Engine control is in the bridge, though
it's done from the bridge.
How is that done again, please?
It's by pressing a button.
Is the engine room notified at that time?
Yes, they notified us.
Did you, were you notified and did you log it at that time?
Yes, I believe it was logged, but I'm not certain.
Do you remember what time that occurred?
Approximately 10 to midnight, I believe, maybe 15 to midnight, somewhere in that time.
Okay. To clarify your propulsion system, to go astern from full ahead, the engine must be first completely stopped and then started again in reverse. Is that correct?
That's correct.
What period of time would that take from full ahead to full astern?
Again, that would depend whether the vessel had way on it in the head direction or whether it was stopped.
Going full ahead for a good amount of time, say in 12 knots.
It might take 2-3 minutes before you get the full astern RPM.
Do you have any idea what it would how long it would take to for the vessel to completely come dead in the water?
Distance-wise?
Right.
No, not really.
On the steering system, we've heard testimony from the bridge mates about testing the steering up there. Are there any tests that are conducted by the engineers on the steering system?
When we test the steering gear prior to leaving port and also during the pre-arrival tests, it's tested from the bridge and it's switched from the bridge from one unit to the other. However, an engineer does go in the steering gear room to verify that, yes, what is supposed to happen is happening.
Were there any tests done of the steering gear after the grounding?
Not immediately, no. We did not want to touch the steering gear because when this particular vessel is at a standstill and or at the dock and you test the gear, you do get significant, you feel significant shudder from rudder movement back aft, so we did not want to do that. Also, we didn't want to test anything prior to diver's inspection of the stern section of the ship. However, we did test the gear prior to refloating the vessel, and the steering gear was used during the passage from Bligh Reef to Naked Island. And excuse me. After I left the vessel, on April 8th, I believe, ABS was on board, and they did request that we test the steering gear just pro forma to say it was tested. I was not there, but I knew it was going to be tested.
Regarding the discussion of ice on the evening afternoon before the casualty, when did this subject come up?
When we were at the Pipeline Club.
Okay. Who brought the subject up?
I don't believe it was the captain. I don't remember whether it was captain or myself. I don't recall.
Do you remember what was said concerning a possible delay of the vessel because of ice?
I don't follow you.
What was said?
I think the gist of it was that if it's very icy out there, the captain would prefer to leave by daylight. Or at daylight.
Was there any discussion about what the ice was like?
No, I, as I said before, I don't know where the captain got the information that it was icy out there, but he must have gotten something from somewhere. Again, my assumption.
You stated that at the when you went back to the Pizza Palace and you went to the harbor, I think it's the harbor bar next door, that you ordered drinks. Did the captain order a drink?
He had something when I came back after ordering a pizza, yes.
Did he drink it?
Yes.
Did you see the captain purchase a bottle of alcohol or any other type of bottle to take back to the vessel? You stated that you've been with Exxon for 19 years. What steps do you know that were taken to enforce alcohol prohibition?
I'm aware of, although I have not witnessed it nor been a party to it, that there have been periodic room searches on ships, crew members, captains at different times have informed the crew of the policies, yes.
What do you know of the alcohol rehabilitation program? Have you heard of a reassignment of personnel due to alcoholism?
I don't know anything about it. I was never a party of it. I don't want to be a part of it. I don't know anything about it now.
Has a program ever been explained to you?
There has been a letter sent to employees saying that it is available, yes.
And again, have you ever heard of anybody being reassigned due to alcohol problems?
I would have no knowledge of that, sir.
Do you know of any company effort to discover DWIs or other violations or convictions of alcohol abuse?
I would have no idea, sir.
Did you discuss this cause of casualty with anyone after the incident?
No, sir.
That's all. Thank you.
Dr. Laresh.
Bob Laresh will be asking questions representing the state of Alaska. He's questioning Jerzy Glowacki, chief engineer at the Exxon Valdez.
It's the Xerox of the bell logger tapes. And most particularly page 3.
You're listening to live coverage of the National Transportation Safety Board hearing from Anchorage, Alaska. This is brought to you by KSKA Anchorage and APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.
You have it. Reading in the center column of this page, I'm told that one reads these things up from the bottom to read them chronologically.
Correct, because it was
correct?
A tape.
Please read up 3 or 4 inches there and find the line that is has 9:05 as a time. I'm assuming that's Zulu time, which would be...
I'm sorry?
That's Greenwich time, am I
that's
correct?
That's GMT, that's correct.
Okay. What was the RPM on this at this time reading?
61 RPM.
61 RPM, okay. So the RPM for...
Dr. Resch, excuse me. Are you looking at 4 India?
4 India, yes, sir. Third page.
Third page?
Page 3.
It's the third one that I was handed.
It has a number in the right-hand corner.
I can't find a number on this one. Basically, it's the one that has just 3 tapes and has a blank on the left.
We don't have that exhibit. Wait a minute.
The chief has it.
Yeah, I'd like for us to have it, too.
Okay.
4J. 4J. Just one page.
The parties are now searching through the record, looking for certain documents. It's called the bell logger tapes, one of the recorders that's on board the vessel. On the stand now is Jerzy Glowacki, who's the chief engineer at the Exxon Valdez. Line of questioning so far has gone down two different lines. First of all, is alcohol use, and secondly, status of the engine the night of the accident.
Is it printed every so many minutes, or is it change, signal it to print?
It prints every time the telegraph is moved from one speed to another. It prints this speed change. It prints the time of that speed change. It also, when I say speed change, I'm talking about an order, movement of the telegraph, okay? It prints the time of that desired speed change. And if the vessel is underway at that time, it also prints what the actual RPM of the engine is at that time.
Okay. Look up at the, or down below the previous one I referenced, the 8:24:24 second.
Right.
Now, at that time, it was bridge control, full ahead, 56 RPMs. Is that correct?
Correct.
The next printing was bridge control, full ahead, 61 RPMs.
Correct.
What would have caused it to print the second one? There's no indication there was a change at the telegraph.
Okay. During a transient change in speed, this automatically prints out a change of any between 4 and 5 revolutions. If there was a change of 4 or 5 revolutions, it will automatically print it out. The actual engine order or desired order is signified by a little chevron on the side of the...
I see. And at 4 or 5, the computer just decides randomly how many RPMs it'll report?
I don't believe it decides randomly. It's you're going through a transient, so it depends when it catches it. I believe electronic. So it's an electronic device.
It's but it's not by time. It's by change in RPM.
There is an also time element involved here. If the vessel is proceeding at what I'm trying to say is that every 4 hours, it will print out automatically also the status.
Okay. So it appears from this that the engine RPMs increased from 56 to 61 over approximately, 39-minute period from 8:24 to 9:05?
Correct.
Okay, and then they increased another 3 RPM in the 5 minutes, in the 13 minutes between 9:05 and 9:18.
Correct.
Is this probably a result of the loading program that was up at the time?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Now, you told us that that you read the RPMs after hearing the noise that you felt might be the turbocharger.
I read the RPM when I came back to the control room after going out to listen to what I thought was the noise coming from the turbochargers.
And looking at this logger tape, would I be correct in assuming you probably read it at about 9:18?
Very close to that, yes.
Okay. And basically, that was 13 or 14 minutes after other evidence shows the grounding. Does that comport with your remembrance of that time? Was this 13 or 14 minutes after you heard the noise?
No, sir. No. No. When I said that I noticed that the engine was at 64 revolutions and that the load was unusual for that number of revolutions, it was very shortly after I heard the noise.
Okay, I assume that this the increase in speed with the loading program up is probably a fairly linear progression. Is that correct? So many RPMs.
The increase in RPM is not linear. The increase in the signal to the governor is linear.
Okay, I understand. So in these 13 minutes that the RPMs increased by three, that's several minutes to go up one RPM. So am I correct in assuming that, in fact, you could have seen the 64 RPM signal reading significantly before 918 on this chart?
Oh, yes. It's a digital readout. And it would float between 63, 64 for perhaps a minute or so, yes, or 2 minutes, yes, until it finally changed, because the digital readout is in whole numbers only. There's no decimals.
Good.
Is that explaining?
Yeah, that's been very helpful. Have you ever been instructed by Exxon management to reduce overtime in the engine room?
I have not been. No, sir.
Would you have expected to receive a memo from Mr. McRobbie, the Exxon fleet coordinator, if he had sent one out to all engineers?
Mr. McRobbie is not the coordinator for our ship.
Exxon has more than one fleet coordinator?
Perhaps we're using different terms.
Okay. But Mr. McRobbie is not in the chain of command above you?
Not me, no.
Okay. If you had been instructed by Exxon to reduce engine room overtime by unlicensed personnel to zero, would that have caused you any concern?
Yes, I would like to talk about it.
Okay. What would your concern have been?
Well, my approach to this would be, hopefully from a realistic point of view, that there are situations where you have to use overtime. I mean, you can't make a blank statement like that.
Okay. Are you a member of a union?
No, I'm not.
Okay. At the start of a series of voyages, I don't know what you call it, a tour of duty or whatever, on board the Exxon Valdez, where do you board?
On this coast, it's generally either San Francisco or Long Beach.
Okay. And is that the case with everyone on the crew, to the best of your knowledge?
Generally, yes.
Okay. Has anyone ever search you or your belongings at any of those places where you board the... Okay. You've been on board Exxon vessels for 19 or 20 years, is that correct?
19 years, sir.
Have your belongings ever been personally... Your personal belongings ever been searched on board a ship? Okay. When you were asked to say what Captain Hazelwood had been drinking in Valdez, you said probably vodka. Was that was what he was drinking, an orange juice or straight clear liquid, you recall?
At the time?
Yeah.
It was clear.
Okay, so when you were at the Pipeline Club, you said that you and the captain discussed whether or not it might be a good idea to wait until daylight to leave because of the ice. Did you discuss other ships' business with them during these 3 hours?
We might have, but nothing of the significance that would make me remember exactly what we talked about now.
Did you discuss personalities of the ship's crew and competency of any of the people working for you two?
No, sir. I don't recall any conversation like that.
Thanks, Mr. Milwaukee.
Thank you. Captain Deppe?
William Deppe asking questions for Exxon.
Just to clarify one point about when the engineers went on watch when you made arrival or departure, or went off watch when you made departure, you're talking about arrival at Cape Hinchinbrook, not arrival at the dock, isn't that
correct?
Oh, yes,
certainly. Yes.
Okay. All right.
Yes.
Thank you. That's all I have.
And also departure at Hinchinbrook. I do not mean to say departure meaning when we drop the pilot off. No.
Thank you. Mr. Colucciello?
Chief, one question about the load indicator. Does it have an associated print record, or is there some memory or some information that would show its changes to us?
No, so it's an analog transmitter. It's a servo transmitter that drives an analog indicator. That's all.
Okay, there is no record.
No, sir.
Thank you. No question. Question is, how long does it take for the load program up? How long does it take?
Approximately 42, 43 minutes, I believe, from 55 to 79 RPM.
And does it have to start at a particular RPM? Or can you start it at any RPM?
Yes, if you wish to go to C speed, you have to stop at start at full maneuvering ahead, which is 55.
Well, if you wanted to, can you put it on into effect before C speed?
The feature that's available to us in the system is that if you are, let's say, at half ahead, but wish to go at a little faster speed, somewhere between half ahead and full ahead, there's another feature that's called fine setting. You can manually increase the speed to whatever RPM you desire between the full ahead and half ahead, as an example, to bring it anywhere you want. But you cannot fine set it past the next speed, which would be full ahead.
Mm-hmm. So, in effect, if you do not use the fine-tuning, the load program up will always bring you up to full C-speed, is that correct?
Load program up is only used to go from full ahead to C-speed or from vice versa, the other way.
And the starting point is at the maneuvering full,
correct,
which is B-55.
Correct.
So you'll start out at 55 and end up with what?
79.
Thank you.
Mr. Danaher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You responded to some questions about the engine room crew reduction from Mr. Sager, and I believe you alluded to the fact that there would be correspondence between Exxon and the Coast Guard. Did you also say that you had seen some correspondence on that?
I have seen copies of some cover letters that were part of that correspondence.
Do you recall who from Exxon that correspondence was signed by?
I believe it was probably from Mr. Paul Myers.
Thank you. No further questions.
I just have one question. In your 19 years with Exxon, have you, you may have already answered it, so if you did, I apologize. Have you ever seen anybody with alcohol on vessel, on board?
No, sir. No, that I recently recall. No, sir.
Have you ever been told by any? Have you ever been told that somebody about people that have alcohol or persons part of the crew that have alcohol on board?
You know, in 19 years, you probably could have heard a lot of things, and I don't. Recently, I do not recall. No.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Klawacki. You're excused.
Yeah.
I'd like to call to the witness stand now Mr. Frank Iarossi, President, Exxon Shipping Company. Mr. Iarossi. Mr. Colucciello, will you swear in the witness and qualify him, please?
Raise your right hand. Do you swear that the testimony you are about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Please be seated. Please state your full name.
My name is Frank J. Iarossi, Frank James Iarossi.
Who is your employer?
Exxon Shipping Company.
And what capacity are you associated
in? I'm the president of Exxon Shipping Company.
And how long have you been in this position?
Since 1982.
Thank you.
I just want to make an announcement for the record. One of the exhibits that Mr. Iarossi may be questioned on are some of the service records that the Safety Board has in their possession. You, the four parties, have information on Mr. Hazelwood's service records. We passed it out to you yesterday. I think that is a partial list of information what we have here. I am not sure that you have all the information on Mr. Cousins, Mr. Kagan, or Ms. Jones. That information has been subpoenaed. We have some of that back in Washington, D.C. It is in the public record. When we get back to Washington, we will review that. What is pertinent, you will be provided. It is in the public docket and will be a part of this investigation.
Mr. Chairman, we'll ask you some further questions.
Good morning, Mr. Iarossi.
Good morning.
Before Exxon, what other work experience have you had?
I graduated from the Coast Guard Academy in 1959. I sailed for the next 4 years, 1 year as a deck officer and 3 years as an engineering officer. I went to University of Michigan for graduate school, and I have a degree in naval architecture, master's degree in naval architecture and in mechanical engineering. I spent 4 years in a technical position with the Coast Guard. I was section head of the Marine Engineering section of. I spent 4 years in a technical position with the Coast Guard. I was section head of the Marine Engineering section of the Merchant Marine Technical Branch. Left the service at the end of 1968 and joined Exxon International in the Marine Technical position. During that time, I also went back to New York University for a MBA degree, and I've been with Exxon in different positions, including 4 years in Japan, heading up a ship construction program. Also spent a couple years as a marine advisor to the corporation, Exxon Corporation. During that time, we were very heavily involved in developing the oil spill response plan that still exists today. In fact, I headed up that project. We also, at the same, roughly the same time, and this was the period right after the Argo Merchant, Amoco Cadiz, so it sponsored a lot of activity. The other operations going on at that time were the development of the navigation and bridge organization manual. And in 1982, I joined Exxon Shipping Company as president.
That navigation and bridge organization manual, is that an international manual?
It was a manual that was developed for all of the Exxon operating fleets. At the time, I think we had 13 different national fleets. And it was developed in conjunction with both shoreside management and captains from all of the different fleets.
And how many fleets are there?
It applies to all of Exxon's tankers.
Okay. And how many fleets does Exxon have now?
I think it's down probably to maybe five national flags. I'm not sure. My responsibilities are strictly the U.S. flag.
Okay. So how does Exxon Shipping Company fit into the corporate structure of Exxon Corporation?
We're responsible for the waterborne transportation of all U.S. domestic product, both ocean movements and inland tug barge type movements. And we do both the own fleet and the chartering operations.
Okay. Before Exxon Shipping Company was formed, how did it fit into the corporation?
The Marine Department at that time was part of Exxon Company USA. In fact, when I first joined the organization, I was general manager of the Marine Department of Exxon USA, and then just a few months after that, Exxon Shipping Company was formed, and I became president.
And how many ships are there in the Exxon Shipping Company, American?
Right now, operational, we have 16 ships, and we have about 18 tug barge units.
And how many of the ships you have or tug barge units are in the North Slope crude trade?
I would say, I'm guessing now, we've probably got 10 ships in the Valdez trade.
And are they any particular size vessel?
Of course, the largest two are the Valdez and Long Beach. We've got two vessels that are 165,000 tons, three vessels that are 75,000 tons, one at 70,000, one at 58,000. And then we have another vessel that's dedicated to lightering North Slope crude in San Francisco Bay. That's 28,000 tons. I think I've got them all.
About, can you give me a rough estimate about how many officers you have and unlicensed personnel in the shipping company aboard the ships?
The ocean fleet, when I took over the company, we had roughly 1,550 employees, of which just over 1,000 were ocean fleet employees, and they're divided roughly in half between licensed officers and unlicensed. Right now, I think that number is down around, the total number is down around 850 to 900, I'm not sure. But again, divided about in half between officers and unlicensed.
How does Exxon Shipping Company's manning levels compare with other U.S. industry?
I'd say we're about comparable. If you take, if you look at the fully automated vessels like the Exxon Valdez, our manning levels are about comparable to the rest of industry, and I think the Valdez is representative of the rest of our fleet. She had a she has a standard complement of 19 at the time of the incident. I think she had 20. She has a certificate for a minimum manning of 15.
Are you comfortable with the manning scales aboard your vessels, number of people?
Yes.
Do you have any other objectives when it comes to the manning of your vessels? Changing sizes or more automation, or how does, what are those objectives, if you have any?
Well, we clearly have moved in our newer vessels. We have six vessels built within the past 8 years, and we have moved on those vessels to a full automation, as has the rest of the industry, I think, on all of the vessels built in the past, say, in the 80s. Move to diesel propulsion, move to full automation.
And has that brought about the reduced manning of the vessels?
Yeah, I think the national standard, whether it's union crew or non-union crew, the national standard has probably been 21, and that applies to container ships. And I'd say, to my knowledge, that goes all the way back to 1982. The first ship I know that was certificated, fully automated, was a vessel called the Eileen Ingram. And that was in 1982. And that sort of became the pacesetter or the model for Coast Guard certification of a lot of other vessels and also manning. I think that had a crew of 20 or 21.
So the way I understand it, as your fleet has been updated, the size of the crews have been reduced slightly?
Yes. The non-automated vessels, I think, are manned about 23, 24. We have two new vessels that are manned with slightly higher complements. They're chemical specialty vessels, and we carry an extra mate and an extra unlicensed pumpmen on those ships because of the nature of their business.
Could you briefly describe how the manning of the Valdez was established?
Yeah, that was done with the discussions and exchanges between the superintendent of construction in San Diego while the ships were being built, and the senior Coast Guard representative. I guess he was the OCMI for San Diego. And I think they were using as a model the Eileen Ingram certificate going back to 1982. So I don't know the details beyond that.
Right. So generally, it sounds like it's done on an individual basis, individual ship basis or class basis?
Yeah, it has to do with the degree of automation that's designed into the vessel. I think the first, the owner at some point in time suggests a desired manning, and then the Coast Guard goes through an analysis of what to do. Our desire was to come out with a certificate that was modeled after the Eileen Ingram. We don't own that ship, by the way. That was another company. And the Coast Guard goes through a process, particularly where it has to do with gaining an unattended engine room certificate, UMS certification. The Coast Guard requires that the engine room be manned for a minimum of 6 months, and during that time you have to have extra complement on board so that you can go to full manning in the engine room. After 6 months, sometimes it's a period of roughly 6 months, the Coast Guard then reviews the operating performance of the vessel. And if they do grant a UMS certificate to the vessel, then you're allowed to reduce your crew.
Has there been an increase in overtime because of the reduced size crews?
No, it's our experience is that it's actually decreased, because while you are reducing, and this applies just to the engine room, of course, while you are reducing the overall size of the crew in the engine room, you're also taking all of the engineers off watch, so that you have a total crew of engineers now, and our standard is four engineering officers, including the chief, and two unlicensed in the engine department. That total crew is now available for day work, for maintenance work. They have a much a greater number of man hours available for maintenance than they would under a circumstance in which many of them were standing watches.
Okay. What about the deck department? I know that you can reduce the engine room pretty well with automation, but has there been any increase in overtime for deck department people?
Not to my knowledge, except maybe you get creep from year to year, but nothing significant.
Now, the manning levels, that does only includes the deck and engine department. It doesn't include steward department.
That's right. We have... one of the reasons we went from 21 to 20 initially on the Valdez and sister ships was because we reduced the stewards department from 3 to 2. We eliminated a utility position that was responsible for cleaning the galley and things like that. We combined that with one of the other two positions in the stewards department.
I understand your mates are considered part of management, so that would eliminate some overtime for them.
Yes.
Are they compensated in any way?
Yes. We had a study, and I think the base year was either 1981 or 1982. I don't recall. But in that base year, we studied all of the overtime records for each officer grade, for all of the officers within those grades. And we came out with an average number of overtime hours that they worked. In fact, we increased it slightly above average. And then we added the income that they would have earned through overtime pay. We added that to base pay. And that's continued to be their base. And we did that, I think it was 1982 or 83, I don't recall.
Okay. Why did you do that? Is there any...
It was part, actually, the first step goes all the way back to 1973, when we made or declared masters as part of management, and then moved a couple years later to put masters on a merit salary pay basis. And it was part of an overall move to broaden the responsibilities and the skills of all of our officers, to increase their management skills, their leadership skills, and basically to all these people were employees, and all of them were supervisors. It was basically to put them more on a total supervisory footing.
Is a copy of that study available? Or is that...
I don't have it, but and I don't know what form it's in, but I think we can certainly provide it.
Thank you. I'd appreciate it. Do you hold, or does the Exxon company hold regular meetings with their captains and engineers?
Yes, usually each year we have a series of what we call senior officer conferences. And most of these series we take in masters, chief engineers, chief mates, and first assistants. And we do it in groups of about 35 to 40. So in a series of meetings, we usually have 5 one-week meetings, conferences. And during those 1 week meetings, we go through a whole range of subjects. It's sort of each year the subjects change.
Is crew size ever discussed during those meetings?
The last series of conferences in 1988, we did discuss crew size.
Did any of that consider fatigue or areas of competition costs between, say, your company and another company? Any comparisons made?
As far as fatigue, part of the discussion was workload, and what we were seeking in this conference was the views of all of the senior officers, and we're now talking about, I guess we're talking about 180 that attended these 5 sessions, and we were seeking their views as to workload, how work requirements could be changed, where the heavy workloads existed in different trades, how those workloads might be better handled through more automation, through changes in equipment, and basically seeking their input into the process, and I guess it was a better part of one day in each of those 1 week meetings.
Do you keep any records of those meetings?
I believe that session we did keep a running record. In fact, what we did, as I recall, is we took the results from the first officer group that went through, and we then use that as a starting point for the next officer group and kind of build on that. So in effect, by the time we got to the end of it, we had kind of a, what I would say, a consensus position of 180 people on what made sense and what their ideas were and what they thought was possible or not possible.
Is there any chance of getting a copy of that one also?
I think so, if we can still find one.
Since
let me say this, if we can still find it, you can have a copy.
Okay. This area up in Prince William Sound, where the Exxon Valdez operated, is environmentally sensitive, as we've all found out recently. Is there any concern about changing manning levels to provide more people to do the different jobs leaving the and entering the port?
Any changes in manning level that we made would be only after we were absolutely convinced we were not jeopardizing safety. And it would be part of a change in either work requirements or automation that replaced work requirements. Okay. None of these changes that we've made are contemplated impact deck officers, by the way. We've had a standard of a master and three mates on our crude oil tankers for perhaps 20 years.
Different subject now. Can you provide a general description of the criterion used for Exxon management to evaluate their mates and chief mates and masters?
Yes, we generally look at five categories, and these categories are clearly defined when we go through our ranking and processes. The five include, and they're not in any particular order, but they include technical and professional skills, management skills, people skills or leadership skills, you might call them, judgment, and support of company policies.
Now, to get to Captain Hazelwood, when did he become a master aboard Exxon ships?
He was a master before I came with the company. I believe it was about 1979. 1980, perhaps. I'm not sure.
And what type of screening process do you use to select your masters?
It's usually a, or I would say it's almost always a consensus judgment of the different fleet managers. I would say probably the process, even most recently, has included a number of fleet captains themselves. Because what you're really doing is grading chief mates. So the masters get very heavily involved. They are the direct supervisors. Their input, I would say, is really the primary input into the process. It's then reviewed by the first line supervisors, which are the ship group coordinators, and then the fleet managers.
About how many fleet managers do you have?
We have two fleet managers currently, and there are two other people who could get involved in that process. One is the human resources manager, and the other is called the fleet services manager. They would get involved because they would also have direct knowledge of the people involved.
And do these people get together and make recommendations to you? Are you the final authority on that?
For masters and chief engineers, yes. For lower ranks, I don't get involved. But for masters and chief engineers, they will make a judgment and provide it to me for review. If I have any direct knowledge of the individuals that might change that judgment, I usually bring it up and discuss it. That's usually not the case. I usually spend my effort in making sure that the process was correct, that we did get a lot of input, that we did consider all factors. So I usually concentrate my attention on making sure the process was gone through and that all of the factors were considered.
Do you have a similar program, evaluation program for your unlicensed people?
I believe that's primarily driven by seniority. It's not a process anything like the officer process.
Would you ever, or any of your shipmasters, develop, say, an AB to try to get him to a mate position?
I believe there are a number of occasions where they might have encouraged unlicensed people to strive for a license. We throughout the fleet strive to get all of our people, licensed officers, to move to a higher level of license. And I would say there are a lot of officers sailing in the fleet who have higher Coast Guard licenses than they are currently using in their position. On the Valdez, for instance, we had two licensed masters. We had two licensed chief engineers. We also have a number of unlicensed people in the fleet who do have third mate's licenses on the Valdez. We had three of the unlicensed deck people on the Valdez had third mate's licenses. fact, I think in total on the Valdez, we had 12 licensed officers. And that's not untypical of the rest of the fleet.
Is that comparable to other U.S. fleets? Do you know?
I don't know. I couldn't make a judgment.
Those five factors you gave for evaluating people or your mates, is there any other ones used for selecting the masters?
No, I would say those are the five general categories that we rate people on. I can't think of any others. No.
Are you aware of any studies of fatigue and crew qualifications? Are there any in progress with your
company? Yes, there is a Coast Guard-sponsored Marine Research Board. It's the Marine Board, part of the National Research Council, which is part of the National Academy of Sciences. They are currently conducting a study on the impacts or the relationships between crew size and safety.
Is Exxon involved in that study in
any
way?
Yes, I'm a member of that group. There are about 12, as I recall, members in the study group, and it's comprised of representatives from three or four companies, two or three national unions, and three or four academics in different phases of the subject.
I'll switch again to another subject. Can you describe the TAPS trade, the TAPS agreement, and Exxon's involvement with it, how it started?
I really don't have any knowledge. I know it goes back to the early 70s. There's, I think, seven partners or seven shareholders in Alyeska. Exxon is one of those seven. We're a minority shareholder. Actually, it's Exxon Pipeline Company that owns the shares. But beyond that, I have no knowledge.
Do you know if the oil is distributed that comes from the North Slope by the shares, or does it make any difference as long as you're a member of those seven or eight companies?
I don't know how the percentages are worked out or what the ownership of the different reservoirs are. I don't know that.
Does Exxon have a shoreside contingency plan for responding to oil spills from the vessels?
Yes, we have a very large oil spill response plan. There are, 20, I counted them before I came here, 28 volumes in the oil spill response plan. And they are divided into three major categories. One is organization. The second is resources and logistics. And the third one is, the third broad category is cleanup methods. I can go further and describe it if you'd like.
No, that's quite all right. How effective have you found those plans? A lot of times there's a lot of things written and people won't read them.
Well, I fortunately did not have to exercise any of those plans in the 7 years that I was in the shipping company until March of 1989, and I had two opportunities, if you'd call it that, in March of 89. The first one involved the grounding of the vessel Exxon Houston just off the coast of Oahu. The vessel was at a single-point mooring, owned by another company, and the mooring chain holding the vessel to the mooring parted, and before the vessel was able to recover, she grounded. We lost about 200 barrels of fuel oil, and the terminal lost about 600 barrels of cargo out of the hose. The hose is parted when the vessel left the mooring. We initiated our response plan. It worked very, very effectively. I'm told that, I believe his name is Captain Larrabee in the Coast Guard, has testified that he would hold out the response on the Exxon Houston grounding as a model oil spill response. It was just 2 weeks later when we had the same, when we had to exercise the same team for the Exxon Valdez.
I'll get that to that in a moment.
So those were two opportunities, if you'd call it that, in 1 month. And we went back 20 years in our history. We got tired after going back 20 years, but we could not find any time when any Exxon Shipping Company vessel had triggered an oil spill response or had caused a oil spill that would have caused a response.
Does your company have any agreements with the Alyeska terminal in Valdez for responding to spills from your vessels?
No. Oh, I think we have an understanding with them that they're the initial responder, but I don't think we have any formal agreements as such. We've traded letters, recent letter, maybe 6 months ago. They asked us to clarify under which circumstances would we exercise our oil spill response team to take control. And I think we told them that in spills roughly over 250 barrels or any spills that they felt were out of their control, we would certainly exercise our response team.
Okay. Now for the evening of the 23rd and the early morning hours of the 24th, can you describe the events which you supervised after you were notified of the grounding?
Yes, I got the call 4:25 in the morning, Houston time. That would be 1:25 in the morning, Valdez time. I got the call from Darrell Warner, who's head of Exxon Pipeline Company. He, in turn, had gotten a call from George Nelson, head of Alyeska. I immediately called